What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, it's like a knight in shining armor from a long time ago. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we want to talk more about stories and storytelling. But, you know, in our last podcast, we talked about interactive storytelling, this idea of collaboratively creating a story in some way or participating within a story in some way. Now let's talk a little bit about what stories that we wish existed but don't. Like, can you imagine some of the greatest authors of all time who maybe died before you felt like they had really produced everything they could have produced? Like, do you have any favorite authors that you wish had lived longer to tell at least one more amazing story?
Oh, of course. Well, actually, what first popped into my mind was poets. I'd love to have more of Uncle Walt and Auntie Em when I'm feeling patriotic. You know, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson. I gotta feel the America, you know, coming up
feel
in me,
right, bubbling up inside you.
But they've been dead a long time,
right? So, well, Lauren, are there any authors that you can think of off the top of your head where you're thinking, man, I really wish I could have had one more book or story or play or poem from this person?
I'm a completely terrible person. The first thing that just popped into my head was George R. R. Martin, who is not actually dead as of the airing of the podcast.
He will be one day.
So you want an insurance policy to guarantee that A Song of Ice and Fire is complete at some point.
Exactly.
And you want it in George R. R. Martin's voice. That's really important, obviously.
Right.
You know, someone else could pick it up, but that wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, no one else would write. And I'm being actually very earnest here, the kinds of descriptions of food and dresses into my political fantasy that he writes.
Well, you guys have both made my choice of Shakespeare seem pedestrian at this point. I am a Shakespearean nut. I love Shakespeare's plays, and I love his poetry as well. And there are already some plays that may or may not belong to Shakespeare. We'll talk more about some of those in a little bit. But there's some lost plays that perhaps we might actually have if he had lived longer to get to the point where he was committing these so that they could be published. You know, in Shakespeare's day,
he wasn't writing them down necessarily any more than to pass
hand
out copies.
The sides.
To,
yeah,
right,
he would give
sure.
the sides to the actors, but the whole purpose of the play was for performance, not for reading. So in Shakespeare's day, very few of his plays ever were published. It was only after his death when his contemporaries began to gather them all together. People who worked in the King's Men production company began to gather his stuff together. And then even then, there were points where scholars have argued whether other plays should have been included. Perhaps there were plays that Shakespeare wrote when he wasn't writing for the King's Men that weren't included.
And a few have been attributed to other authors.
Sure. Now,
think Shakespeare didn't write any of those plays.
They're
right?
wrong. So I would love it if Shakespeare could churn out a few books. I would love it if Dickens could finish The Mystery of Edwin Drood, because there's nothing more irritating than a mystery that ends halfway through.
Killed him?
Or did he even die?
Oh, yeah.
He may have just disappeared.
There's a science fiction book that C.S. Lewis never finished before his death that I would very much like to read the ending to.
Would have liked to have read The Silmarillion as if Tolkien had actually written it in a form that was meant to be read by a human being, as opposed to a collection of things that his son pulled together from various works and notes and then put into
kind of bizarre encyclopedia.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I genuinely love The Silmarillion, but I wonder what it would have been like had Tolkien actually himself put it all together.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, there are lots of different examples, obviously. Hunter S. Thompson, Kurt Vonnegut. I mean, there's some authors out there I would love to have been able to read
stuff.
And Charles Dickens. Oh, I already mentioned him. My Anglophile traits are starting to show.
And there is always fan fiction. I mean, you know, some fan authors can write very convincingly in an author's voice.
Well, what if we could create a fan fiction style author that wasn't really a person? Before I get into that, we're going to have to talk a little bit about some terms here, like artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence? What does that have to do with literature?
Well, we're going to get there.
We'll get there.
We'll take some steps first. So artificial intelligence or machine intelligence, this is a concept that's been around for more than half a century at this point. And it was something that was kind of played with early day in the earliest days of computer science. In fact, before we even called it computer science, one of the fathers of the concept of artificial intelligence, you could argue, is Alan Turing. Now, Turing was a computer scientist before there was a word for such a thing, who worked for the British government. He was working within the War Department to help decode messages that were sent by Germans using the Enigma machine. You guys familiar with that?
He, like, cracked the code, didn't he?
He was on the team, and yes, he was highly responsible for cracking the code of the Enigma machine. The Enigma machine was a physical, mechanical device that the Germans were using that you would set to a particular setting. It had certain reels, and then what you would do is it had, like, a typewriter, and as you would type, the reels would channel an electric signal through so that a particular light bulb would light up on the other side. But it was designed in such a way so that it would encode each letter. So if you typed a G, one thing you could be sure of is that the one bulb that's not going to light up on that board is G. And in fact, that was one of the few things that Turing was able to figure out that broke the code, was knowing that whatever the letter was that you were looking at an encoded message, it was definitely not the
real. Yeah.
Exactly. And you would think eliminating one choice would not give you that big of an advantage, but that was kind of the crack that really helped break it open.
Okay, so what did Alan Turing have to do with the idea of artificial intelligence?
So he was very much interested in this idea of what's the capability of the machine world? Are there limits? Can it go as far as humans can go?
Can machines think?
Can machines think? He thought about that in such a way, it's a little different than the way you might initially imagine a machine thinking. Turing said it wasn't really important if machines thought the same way that people do. In other words, what was necessary from Turing's point of view was that the output of a machine would be indistinguishable to what a human would be capable of doing but the process doesn't matter.
Not that the process was identical, right?
Yeah. So in other words, if the machine was able to produce something that to you seemed the same as the way a human would produce it, it didn't matter how the machine did it. It just meant that that machine possessed some form of intelligence. And I'll explain that in a second, too. In 1950, he published a paper, Computer Machinery and Intelligence, and proposed the idea of the Turing test. Now, in general, today, the way we talk about the Turing test is a simple version would be you have a computer in front of you, a computer terminal. All you get is text. And your text is going to someone that's in another room. And that might be a person or it might be a machine.
So you're like in a chat setup.
Yeah. Yeah. And you cannot see the other person at all or the machine at all. All you see is whatever shows up on your screen. And you type in a message and a message returns back to you that's generated either by a person or a machine. The Turing test said that if you were unable to determine to a certain degree of certainty whether or not the thing on the other end was a person or a machine, that machine was said to pass the Turing test. So
if it could imitate human speech through text.
Yes. So if the machine was able to carry on a conversation in such a way that it would convince you that it's another person, then it could pass the Turing test. It would at least seem to possess intelligence. And here's how Turing kind of thought about this. It's kind of a philosophical way of thinking about intelligence. So Jonathan Strickland, I know that I possess at least some level of intelligence because I have that personal experience. I know what it means in an abstract way to myself.
Sure.
When I talk to you, Lauren, and you start to display several of the same things I associate with intelligence, I then assume you too possess intelligence of some level. And that is just something that I am granting to Lauren from my perspective because I cannot inhabit Lauren. I can't know what her experience really is. I can only base that upon the observations I make of her behavior. Turing says, well, if we do that, if you assume that every person you encounter has some level of intelligence, why would you not offer a machine the same courtesy? If it seemed to display the same sort of behaviors, you might as well say it has intelligence because there's no way that you can inhabit that machine just as there's no way you can inhabit another human being.
And in fact, saying that we know the machine is different because we programmed it might be an example of the genetic fallacy, right? The idea that because you know where a phenomenon came from, that proves it's not genuine.
Sure. Yeah. And so when we get to the actual Turing test, we've had plenty of people design various kinds of software. Usually they're called chatbots. These are just programs that are designed to interact with people and respond in a conversational way through some context.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have been pretty successful.
Surely they could never really trick somebody, right? I mean, I've talked to Smarter Child on Instant Messenger. I don't think that's a person.
It all depends on, again, the context and how well designed the program was. So, for example, one of the earliest that was designed was ELIZA, which was created by Joseph Weizenbaum. And ELIZA was effective within a certain context in that it was presenting a point of view of almost kind of a naive person, someone who has very little real world experience. And so as long as the real human being had that same kind of perspective, it was, you know, fairly effective. There was another one called Parry, P-A-R-R-Y, that was made by Kenneth Colby, and that one simulated a paranoid schizophrenic responding to questions. And what they did was they ran a whole bunch of conversations between an interviewer and actual patients who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia and conversations with Parry, and then printed out all those conversations, handed that to a panel of judges who were made up of psychologists, and they had a success rate of 48% of saying which one was real and which one. Now, in that case, you're talking about a specific context that has its own limiting factors.
Right, sure. Yeah, yeah. You're talking about two different, hypotheticals of a human person that aren't the kind of conversation that you would normally have
on a day-to-day
basis.
Stray from the norm. And in the case of Parry, you're talking about a conversation that was not conducted by the actual panel of judges. right? So their experience is very different from someone who sits down at a terminal and is actually having the conversational moment. They're reviewing something that's already happened. That's different too. I mean, that experience is different. But there are other examples too. There's the Artificial Linguistic Internet Computer Entity, also known as ALICE. And there's a one that was made by Rollo Carpenter called Jabberwocky. Was Brilligan the Slightly Toves. That one was meant to simulate human chat in a very kind of humorous way. I actually tried this one out before we came to the podcast. Yeah. I wish I'd been able to print out our conversation because, I mean, you could tell that it was, or I could tell it was a chat bot, but for one thing, I already knew. So that's problematic, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I already know going into it.
Very scientific.
Right. I would need to have like a double blind test if I really wanted to do this properly. But, also there were other giveaways. Like it would ask you a question and I would answer, cause it was being snarky. I was being snarky. I answered in a snarky way and then it didn't know how to deal with that. Like it didn't have enough keywords to work off of. So it would go with a stock response that was just a generic response. And in fact, that's the way a lot of these chatbots work. Is that they search for keywords in the things that the person, the interviewer, is typing in, and then it generates a response based upon those keywords. And if none of the keywords that it normally, quote-unquote, knows, as in it keywords that are in its database, then it will generate some other form of response, either a generic response or it will repeat something that it had already said previously in the mm-hmm. conversation.
So what are some of the ways that we think a chatbot could get really convincing? Because I'd imagine that we're not there yet.
Right.
But we're getting better.
We are getting better.
And obviously there's some kind of hurdle we'd have to get over. There's some like strategy for supplying these things with conversation rules that we haven't quite achieved yet. I mean, would machine learning have anything to do with it?
Sure.
Like the idea of maybe mining thousands of other conversations to establish rules about how real people interact.
Or even having every time the machine has a conversation that it ends up reviewing that afterward and learning from its own experiences. I mean, these are...
Right, because, you know, it's human vocabulary and human understanding don't stop when you learn a language. We're continually learning our own languages. We're learning new rules for it. We're learning new vocabulary for it.
We're creating things like metaphor and simile. We're creating mm-hmm. these ideas, these abstract ideas that make sense to people who are native speakers of that language, who have had exposure to this sort of thing, mm-hmm. but to something that is just creating, you know, working out of, say, a very strict dictionary of words, it would be meaningless or confusing.
This reminds me of that time that IBM taught, remind me the name of the computer. They
Watson.
Yes, they taught Watson Urban Dictionary.
Oh, no.
Then after Watson started talking back at them a little bit too much, they were just like, let's just nuke that portion of Watson from
orbit. Yeah, it's the only way to be sure. Yeah, it turned out that Watson developed a bit of a potty mouth. Like, are you familiar with the show Breaking Bad?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know how Jesse ends most of his sentences?
Yeah.
That's pretty much how Watson was ending his sentences. Yeah, they found out it was, I think, Urban Dictionary, and it was one other thing, too, that I think it may have been Wikipedia, but I'm not sure. But they
just
fed that into Watson.
Just get it to mine 4chan for how to talk.
Yeah. Well, then it just becomes unintelligible, right?
Right.
Hacksaw.
Yeah. Okay, so I think I've seen, I could be wrong about this, what I think I remember seeing was that most recently Ray Kurzweil said he thought that chatbots would reliably be able to beat the Turing test by 2029.
And to be fair, when we say beat the Turing test, there's no hard and fast rule.
Right. I think what that just means
it's
is
subjective,
reliably fool the judges.
Right, yeah, because there's... It all depends upon whom you ask, right? Some people say you need to fool people at least 30% of the time and then you beat the Turing test. Other people say, well, Turing had suggested that you show it to a panel. And if the majority of the panel thinks that it's a real person when in fact it's a computer, then the computer beats the Turing test. It all depends on how you frame it. There is not like a magical, this is the way the test should be administered. And this is the only way you can tell if you pass or fail. I just want to make that clear because when we say passing the Turing test, that's so fuzzy. We really are talking about if you the listener, you who are listening right now, if you were to have a conversation with one of these machines, you would not be completely certain whether or not that was a machine or a person. We see this actually used a lot in corporate settings for things like customer service. So if you ever have one of those customer service things pop up when you are on a website and it says, "Do you need some help?" Often, this ends up being a chatbot that actually just has a very deep series of keywords that relate back to the products and services of that company, so that when you start typing things in, it can start sending you to links that possibly can solve your problem, but more likely will cause you to go into a red-hot rage burning brighter than 1,000 exploding suns.
Of course, there the goal is to get you to the information or service that you need. It's not really to trick you into thinking like, wow, I really just formed an emotional connection with this person.
Or the goal is to cut down on the cost of manning actual human beings in customer support roles. But that your point stands either way.
So I would like to imagine a future where we're proposing the next Turing test.
Okay, so we've gotten to the point where we can have a conversation and not be sure if it's a person or a machine.
Yeah, so
either because the machines have become really smart or people are just dumb as bricks.
Yeah, imagine we get there. Well, let's say it's 2029. Kurzweil was right.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got chatbots that people cannot tell.
Okay.
The chatbot from a human. The every single time, you know, it's statistically insignificant.
It's okay.
Sure.
Once we're there, what's the next step? What's the next hardest thing in that same sort of realm of imitating human intelligence?
Well, Joe, since this whole podcast is about storytelling, I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark and say it's storytelling.
That's my guess. I think that'd be really interesting. I mean, so we can sort of imagine, like, the chatbots we've interacted with today, they can't really do conversation, but we can imagine it. We can see it.
Yeah.
Storytelling. Now, on one hand, I can imagine how an AI story bot would work, but on the other hand, it seems so alien to me. Surely they couldn't really create a piece of AI that could tell stories that seemed as good as human stories, right?
I think it would be a huge challenge, but I don't see anything that's fundamentally impossible about it.
If you take the fact that there are programs these days that can create music or create works of visual art, then, you know, and those are based on a few thousand rules about what makes a good piece of whatever media.
Right.
Okay.
So,
well, let's set it up now. Let's describe the literary Turing test.
Okay.
What kind of test would a story bot have to pass?
Well, you'd have to be able, I would say, to read the story and feel like it was
satisfying.
Satisfying, for lack of a better word, organic. That it did not, it was not just a series of choppy sentences where a person goes through some mundane task. It would need to be engaging. I know you love that word, Joe. I keep using it because of that. But it would need to captivate an audience in some way, either because of the actual plot or the characterization or some combination thereof. And it would need to have a narrative flow. It would need to have internal consistency. So in other words, things that happen earlier in the story could not be contradicted later in the story. Let's say that you have a story about a father, and the father experiences the heartbreak of a child dying, and that's a terrible thing. This is something that we would encounter in a story, a novel, whatever.
Sure.
But then three chapters later, the child's there, and nothing has gone wrong, and it's not like it's mystery or anything. It's just that the child had never died. That would be a problem.
Right. And either, you know, either adhering to those rules, or if it breaks those rules, to be breaking them in a way that seems conscious and
purposeful. Exactly. It couldn't just be breaking rules indiscriminately.
Yeah.
Here's my blanket rule for the literary Turing test I've imagined.
Okay.
It doesn't have to create stories that are as good as your favorite author. It just has to do, in the same way that the original Turing test didn't have to be as great a conversationalist as your most interesting friend.
Right.
It just has to be good enough that you think this is probably written by a human being.
Sure. I've read some awful stories, so the bar is set fairly low. We're going back to that fan fiction thing now.
Yeah, but you've read some awful stories, but even people who are bad writers write better stories than we could generate now with AI. Oh, come on.
I've read some really bad stories.
Yeah, okay. I've read some really bad things.
Well, let's put it this way. The way a computer would generate a story right now, the only way I think you could have one where it would have any sort of actual sense to it, unless you were to have an incredibly powerful computer and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of programming time built into it, would be if you went the Mad Libs approach, where you had a story outline that already existed and the computer was just filling in the blanks. And even okay. then, it's not necessarily going to make a whole lot of sense.
Of course, that wouldn't be generating
no.
the original story.
No, that yeah. would. In fact, I've seen generators that do this kind of thing
sure.
where they follow very simple rules. So, for example, my father created a program in Apple Basic back in 1985, I want to say. So, yes, we had computers back then. And he created this program that was a science fiction novel title generator. And it had just very simple rules where it would take some ridiculous adjective and ridiculous nouns and pair it up together so that you would get a sentence or a title that would just sound like, yeah, I could totally see that being on the store shelf mm-hmm. in the science fiction fantasy section.
Uh-huh. The burning lampshade of Venus.
Right.
Kind of
exactly.
Stuff.
That
yeah.
would be a, mm-hmm. that would be a great example.
It reminds me of I saw online a while back a James Bond movie title generator, but that one spit out horrible things. It was like the last day to gun or like
well, yeah because it was
my favorite was ball eyes.
It's because it was taking existing James Bond titles and yeah. breaking them up and then putting them back together, so instead of creating a really deep database of words to work from, it was just like, let's put in every title of every
ball
James
eyes.
Bond film yeah, yeah. So Thunderball and GoldenEye, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, yeah. So okay. the components that we're trying to smush together here to create this literary Turing test passing machine are that vocabulary. You mm-hmm. you want to have yeah. enough vocab so that you're not just ball eyes yeah, into the next century.
It'd be
you know?
The most basic. It would just have to know what words mean in a robust way.
Right, right. You know, it needs to be able to work with the tropes and metaphors of the culture that it's writing for. I mean, because, you know, a lot of books will contain, a lot of stories contain references to countless other stories and
sure.
and are using the bits and pieces, the devices and conventions of storytelling that a culture is used to.
Right. They're either deliberately playing on those tropes or they're deliberately defying them. But in either case, it's something where the awareness is important,
mm-hmm.
both for the storyteller and the audience.
It's got to have a advanced level of machine learning, which you guys mentioned earlier, which is the science of getting a computer to do something without explicitly having told it to do it.
Right, because there are just too many rules. You could not possibly code them directly.
Right, sure. It's you know, machine learning is what's behind something like telling a Google car to go down a street without it ever having seen that street before.
Right.
You know, it's also what goes into web search and lots of other, you know, the Human Genome Project, everything like that is mm-hmm. based on machine learning. And then a basic, I mean, not basic because this is actually really huge, an ontology, a semantic or abstract model of data, that builds upon databases, which are logical or physical.
Okay.
So, you know, it's, the term comes from philosophy, where it's used to describe studies of nature or existence, and it was picked up by early AI researchers to define the objects, concepts, and other entities that are presumed to exist in some area of interest and the relationships that are held among them.
Right. So let's make this concrete. Let's imagine a story.
Okay.
Say there's a story where there's like a murder or something.
All
right. You know, Colonel Mustard kills Mr. Body. And this is a murder mystery about the story. Well, the computer that's generating the story would have to have such a robust understanding, not just of what a word like knife means, like not just that it's a noun or whatever, but that it has relationships. So it can be found in the kitchen. It can be used for murder.
Yeah, maybe it's found in Mr. Body.
Yeah. It can, but it can also be a clue.
Sure.
And but there's also metaphors about being on a knife's edge.
Right.
Or,
and
right.
so
and
it
so
would
it
have to understand.
Know that as well, yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't just have to have knife in, like, its library, but it would have to have a connected web of relationships to other terms.
Furthermore, you would have other relationships you'd have to determine, like the fact that you would have, Colonel Mustard as murderer, Mr. Body is victim, but you might have Mr. Green as suspect. You might have Scarlet as suspect. You know, these would be different definitions. And then not only do you define everything, but then you have to relate them all to one another.
Right. That's the big thing. That would make it even more complex, because in order to have good fiction, you have to have strong characterization and relationships between the characters. So you'd need ontologies that defined characters by, like, is in love with or has a grudge against.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Is afraid of.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Or, for example, in our Clue or Cluedo example, we could go back to not only is Mr. Green a suspect and Colonel Mustard is the murderer, but Colonel Mustard views Mr. Green as a patsy.
Yeah.
Now, the other characters would not view Mr. Green as a patsy. And within the narrative of a story, that would be clear to the audience, but not clear to the characters within the context of that story. It's a very simple thing for us to think about as human beings. This is something that comes very naturally to us. Obviously, when you're watching a movie or reading a book, you are aware of certain things that other characters are not aware of. And if those characters magically become aware of them, that pulls you out of the moment. I could see that being a very challenging thing to quote unquote teach a computer.
Yeah.
To know that you have
dramatic
to,
irony exists and can be used in these ways, right, but not in these ways.
And just because one character is aware of something does not necessarily mean that another character is aware of that same thing. I had an experience like that this week where I was watching something and I thought, wait a minute, how does this character even know this? And it totally pulled me out of the story.
Yeah. It's clear just how difficult this is.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to say, frankly, it seems impossible to me now, but I wouldn't say it's actually impossible.
Well, I would have said that a computer beating Jeopardy champions at Jeopardy would have been impossible, you know, a couple of years ago. And then IBM with Watson totally proved me wrong. And they did it in a way where Watson was not even connected to the internet. It was all self-contained. So the fact that there could be a self-contained database of enough information to be able to anticipate practically anything that Jeopardy can throw at you. And Jeopardy is a game that includes things like wordplay, where it's not just a standard, here is your answer, what's the correct question? You may mm-hmm. have to interpret that answer beyond just what the words say.
Yeah, there's little jokes and et cetera.
Yeah, there might be puns, mm-hmm. there can be references. So the fact that the fact that IBM was able to create a computer that was capable of doing this, I hesitate to say impossible. I think it's an incredibly difficult task. I would hesitate to go so far as to say it's an uncrackable task.
Yeah. So what's it like right now? This is what we are imagining in the future.
Yeah, Joe, I hear that you have some examples of computer-generated poetry.
Yeah. So obviously, I think it's pretty clear poetry is easier, I think, for machines to generate than fiction at this point.
Because the rules of poetry are a little bit looser. We expect poetry to be
abstract.
Wackier, well, abstract.
Yeah.
A lot of people expect poetry, you know, you can expect it to be associative rather than narrative. And it's actually, it's got to be really difficult to get a computer to generate a coherent narrative, unless it's just following like a pre-supplied skeletal structure or
sure.
something.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. To tell a computer, hey, tell me a fantasy story. Here are four characters you have, and here is one important piece of information that you need to incorporate. Go. That would be, like you say, Joe, right now, that's really hard to imagine.
I mean, it's impossible now. It wouldn't be able to. I mean, the computer just doesn't understand events and the progression of events enough to tell a coherent narrative from one, you know, that feels meaningful in any way.
Yeah, I mean, why didn't the Eagles just give them a ride to Mordor at the very beginning if they could?
right. But speaking as someone who basically majored in poetry in college and very nearly went on to do an MFA in poetry, writing good poetry
is really hard.
Is incredibly difficult.
Oh, hey, I am right there with you. I also studied poetry and I love poetry. The difference is that you can get away with more associative
sure.
stuff. Now, it might not be poetry that anybody really cares to read more than once, but it can pass for a poem.
Okay.
So this is I found this book. It was published in 2011 by Pure Press, edited by a computational linguist named Aurelie Hertelo. And this is a book of poems called Discourse.cpp.
Okay.
That was created by a computer that was designed to generate ontologies. So what we were talking about before, you know,
right.
The idea of
associations.
Establishing meaning for terms that it finds on the internet and relationships with other terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that this book was created by was by machine learning. It was by looking at tons and tons of text on Wikipedia and trying to establish relationships between terms,
okay.
And then using that to auto-generate poems based on the semantic relationships that it had determined.
I bet its poem about citation question mark is amazing.
Okay, The Umbrella.
Okay, this is one we have not heard yet. Okay. We heard one earlier that actually Lauren and I both agreed, like, we could imagine a terrible poet wrote
it. We'll get to it, Jonathan.
No. I don't want you to read that one. I want you to read just ones I have not heard yet.
The Umbrella. You want an umbrella, and all you have is a flannel handkerchief and a sponge.
That's it?
That's brilliant.
Bicycles.
No, wait. I'm still taking an umbrella.
Okay.
A flannel handkerchief and a sponge. That's a
written
day in my life.
Written by a computer.
Okay. Go with another one.
Bicycles by the computer. The cycles dominate the street. An infantry of two-wheeled implements, tricycles and rickshaws, most of them far-left crutch carriages. The pilots are no duffers. Visitors rent higher-priced engine-powered recumbent three-seaters, flashlight and tulip included. All commute as one would ski.
Pretty sure E.E. Cummings wrote something like that.
But hey, no, I want to read the good one.
This one,
actually, this was kind of amazing.
Yeah, so
this is the only one that we had heard.
I actually like this one.
Yeah.
If a human wrote this, I would think it was kind of interesting. Okay. It's called Love. To love, rather like, prefer, and wish. To want, first bother, then approach, chase, catch, eat, and kill. Thank you. To love, to remind and remember. To know and to forget. Ooh, that last line's kind of a chiller.
I just like to the bother part, because as I said earlier in our pre-meeting, I said this sounds like the middle school approach to romance, like bother the person first and then convince them to come. Or the Anakin Skywalker school of courtship.
So that's where we're at in 2011. Computer generated poetry.
And I think that what we can kind of take from this is that it's easier to write poetry about something abstract like love than it is about something concrete like a bicycle.
Right, like a narrative poem. I mean,
I would really be curious to see what the first computer-generated stab at something like Beowulf would be, like an epic saga.
Well, I would say probably, so you have poetry on two sides. It's probably easier for a computer to write abstract or lyrical poetry than it is to write prose fiction, but it's probably even harder for a computer to write narrative poetry than it would be for the computer to write prose fiction, right?
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Because then you've got to deal with all those difficulties of coherent, progressive narrative, and you've also got to deal with whatever, you know, poetic tropes you're using, like have a length of a line.
Right, exactly. You know, like how much alliteration needs
to
be there.
Is this blank verse?
Yeah, especially for something like Old English where it was all alliterative and not rhyming poetry. One of the things that you brought up in the video, and I think it's a really interesting idea, is let's say that we get to the point where computers are able to simulate, to a certain extent, the ability to tell a story. And mm-hmm. It will really depend heavily upon what rules the programmer creates, right? So in other words, if I were to program an artificially intelligent storyteller, the stories that would come out of that computer would reflect the rules I had created. which might be different from the rules you create, Joe. You might think that, you know, especially something as simple as whether or not you value one aspect of storytelling over another could make wildly different stories. But we could get really granular, like to the point of how frequently do I use the word "the" versus how frequently you use it.
And that actually matters.
Yeah.
That actually contributes to somebody's authorial voice.
Oh, right. You can actually take a genetic imprint of an author's voice based on, I think, Joe, you've got a bunch of notes on this one, based on like the number of times that they use particular words and the scope of their vocabulary.
Sure.
And,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
And the grammatic structure of their sentences.
Okay. Well, let's start with an idea. In 1996, I think it was, somebody published a novel called Primary Colors.
Okay.
You all know the story?
I do not know the story.
I do not know.
Well, Primary Colors was a political novel. It was a Romana Clef, which was a thinly veiled story about the Bill Clinton campaign in 1992. With the names changed and stuff like that. But it was published anonymously. The author didn't reveal his or her name.
Gotcha.
And so there was a big question, like, well, you know, we don't know who wrote this, but people were really curious. They wanted, you know, they were positing all these names who were insiders on the Clinton campaign and stuff like that. And there was a Vassar College Shakespeare professor named Don Foster, who I've got this interesting CNN article from 2000 about him and about how he used literary textual analysis to determine who he thought the author was. And he thought it was the columnist Joe Klein. And it turned out years later, Klein admitted that Foster had been correct.
Oh, wow.
So how did Foster identify him? Well, it was just straight up textual comparison.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking at the text of the novel and looking at the idiosyncrasies of the kinds of vocabulary and sentence construction, just how the text read, comparing that with all kinds of other famous writers. And when he finally stumbled across Joe Klein's column, he said, aha, here we go. It's this guy. Because he uses the same kinds of words in the same order, the mm-hmm. voice you can just easily identify. And he was correct. Now, actually, you don't need a really skilled Shakespeare professor to do something like this these days.
Though it helps.
It helps.
Because as we were talking about at the very top of the show, Shakespeare produced a lot of work, and some of the work that is attributed to Shakespeare is probably a collaboration with other authors.
Sure.
In some cases, they're known collaborations. In other cases, there are plays where it's suspected that Shakespeare did not start the play, but he finished it. And so having someone who is specialized in examining the way a particular writer wrote and being able to compare other works against that body of known work or attributed work is very, very useful when you're trying to determine, like, is this actual play that we discovered that has no name attached to it, is that actually a lost Shakespearean play or whatever?
Yeah. So there are all kinds of anonymous works throughout history. Think mm-hmm. about the Federalist Papers, right?
Uh-huh.
They were all these, what were they, articles published in newspapers, I guess. They were
broadsides,
written by John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison, right?
Yeah. You're looking at me. I'm the English history guy.
So they were published anonymously. But I wonder if you could write a computer program
mm-hmm.
that can look at these three works and group them into different author sortings and then compare those different groups to works that we know by each of those three authors and figure out which ones wrote which. Well, bam, we've got it.
So this is essentially like fingerprint analysis, where you're looking for points of comparison that are identical against multiple criteria, whether using both the anonymous work and then the known body of work, right?
Yeah. So one example of this type of software is a free piece of software called Signature. It's the Signature Stylometric System.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a computer program used for textual analysis. And one of the things it's used for is to assess authorship in a book where the author is questionable, or to identify an author in the case of an anonymous work, like we were talking about with the Federalist Papers.
Sure.
And so how does it work? Well, it does the same thing that Don Foster did with primary colors, except it has an organized system of analyzing text in a machine readable way.
Mm.
So it can look at idiosyncrasies in the way you structure sentences or in the frequency with which you use certain words, or it can look at the frequency of common function words like we were talking about before.
So sure.
Just using to and from and but and.
If you frequently misuse a word, that's a dead giveaway.
Oh, yeah.
And it does
that's
happen.
Huge.
Oh, sure.
You know.
And all of the things that go together to form an author's voice, a distinctive authorial writing style, mm-hmm. are things that can be used to identify the author. And we're getting better and better at this. There's another textual analysis tool. It was created by grad students at Drexel University, and it's called JStylo. And let's say you've got an anonymous work here. And what it does is, let's say the work is about 500 words, and you have a pool of maybe 50 potential authorial candidates, and you have maybe 6,500s of words of text from each of the candidates. They say that's enough for it to identify the 500-word sample, the author of the 500-word sample, with a very high degree of certainty.
Wow.
Funny enough, this is kind of a side note, but they also created something that works the other way. So if we're getting better and better at using software to identify the author of anonymously written text, that seems like it could put people like whistleblowers at risk.
Oh, sure.
So
yeah.
they came up with a program that does the opposite. It's called Anonymouth, and it takes text that you write and helps you retranslate it out of your voice.
Oh, I see. I was just about to say, like, I could see this being a thing that hurts anonymity online, something that we already know is becoming a precious commodity.
Sure. You know? But instead of just running it through Babelfish and into Russian and then Chinese and then back to English, then...
Where you're thinking, like, I think I know what you're saying.
So this is really interesting. How does this all relate to our AI storyteller?
Well, yeah, this idea of...
If
we can work backwards,
right.
Then can we work backwards to, say, create the Silmarillion the way that Tolkien would have written it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you can look at the rules that generate an author's voice,
mm-hmm.
and if you can derive rules enough to identify an anonymous work, you can potentially derive rules well enough to generate new work, right?
Sure.
But,
you know, can we generate a story the way that an author would have created a story? Because that's emergent behavior right there. I mean, that's something more than the sum of its parts.
Again, it's one of those things where I'm pulled in both directions. On one hand, I can see how this would work. On the other hand, it seems so impossible.
Also, I mean, I edit novels freelance, and like I said, I was a writing major in college, and the idea of a computer writing a story is personally offensive to me. Like coming into this podcast, I was angry about the very thought. Like I was totally ready to kill that computer before it took my job. But doing research for it, I found something that Ray Kurzweil wrote that kind of struck me, and he was talking about Harold Cohen, who was a computer programmer and artist who taught a program 1,000 rules for drawing and had it draw some stuff. And Kurzweil asked, okay, so who's the artist? Cohen claims that he is, and that his computer has not been programmed to complain. And I just thought that was a very neat way of looking at it. You know, looking at creating a program that can itself be regarded as a work of art, and that what it creates being something new and not necessarily, you know.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think the idea of recreating work in the voice of another author, an existing author, is very interesting. I would be eager to see the first, what we would deem truly successful example of that.
If it's possible at all, it's a long way off.
Again, I think it's probably possible, but I do agree that it's a long way off. I think that creating something
about
in a particular,
40 years.
yeah, 20 to 50.
20 to 40, 20 to 50 years.
Yeah.
I think actually creating something in a particular person's voice is in some ways easier because you are limiting the choices that your computer program can make.
Yeah.
They cannot choose something that would go outside of that. Now, with some authors, with some people who have created stuff, that's particularly tricky. For example, again, I go back to Shakespeare. And the reason I do is because not that Shakespeare was creating brand new plots. We all know Shakespeare took almost every single one of his plots either from history and then he revised it heavily, or he took it from a pre-existing work, but then put it into his own voice with his own motivations and characters. So that's not, you know, that wouldn't surprise me to be able to create another Shakespearean style just based upon a previous existing plot. The problem is that Shakespeare was also known for creating words. He created words that we use in our vocabulary. He created phrases and metaphors that are now part of our common, you know, vocab in English-speaking nations. And to be able to recreate that would be particularly difficult, so that it would feel natural, that you would create new metaphors and new phrases that would become something that people, you could see people quoting. I mean, people are going to quote it. It's a play. You gotta quote it if you're doing it as a play. So that part is, it's hard for me to imagine, but I still would be reluctant to say it's impossible.
Right. So your question is basically just, can a work that is created based on a set of rules have meaning?
Can it have meaning, and can it be true?
Can it have ingenuity?
Yeah. Can it, and, you know, I think, you know, meaning is one of those things that is found within the reader. You get two readers to read the same piece of work, and it doesn't matter if that piece of work is regarded as the best literature ever written or if it's just, you know, pulp fiction or anything in between. One reader might get a lot out of it, and another reader might get nothing out of it.
Or they might get two totally different things,
yeah,
both of value out of it.
Right.
Maybe I'm just a sucker, but I felt a little bit of meaning in the computer's poem about love.
You're a sucker.
I did too.
It affected me.
That, yeah,
it wasn't poetry. It didn't even rhyme. The interesting thing here, again, goes back to the Turing test, right? Maybe the stuff that's produced has meaning. Maybe the machine never realizes that there's any meaning. And Turing would say, what's the problem? Because we just assume that the person who is creating something is seeing meaning there, and we cannot be sure that that's the case. Great examples there are when you have literature classes that say, like the teacher is going on and on about how a certain passage in a book actually represents this one particular thing. And then you talk to the author and like, no, that part is about a guy having breakfast, which is pretty much what I wrote.
Actually, this is not a problem for me to imagine at all. We are so eager to find meaning.
Right. And personify machines to begin with.
Yeah,
so
we find meaning in things that weren't designed by anybody at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we find meaning in, like, if I walk outside and I'm feeling a certain way about, I don't know, about a relationship I'm in or my job or something, and I see a hawk swoop down and grab a mouse. I mean, the hawk isn't trying to create meaning or entertainment
for me.
That
hawk isn't thinking, I'm a metaphor.
Right, but I will interpret. I mean, that'll become meaningful to me. I'll see meaning in this utterly random event.
Well, sure. I mean, people also will create patterns where there, or see things within patterns where there was no actual thing there, right?
Yeah, so
like looking up at the clouds and saying, oh, look, it's very like a whale.
So
here's a Shakespeare reference for you.
I don't think a person had to necessarily choose a word to go in a certain place in a sentence for that word to have a meaningful effect on me.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if this ever becomes a reality. I assume it will. If it is possible, it will happen. That we can go ahead and just say, because I think it's one of those things you can say about the future is that if something is possible, someone will do it. So it's just a question
of the nature of human curiosity. Yeah.
So it's just a question of when, assuming that it is possible. I'm curious to read it. I may feel that it is a much better novel than, let's see, I'm just going to pick one of the novels I hated reading in school. And it's a toss-up between Tessa the D'Urbervilles and Ethan Frome. So take whatever you like. But anyway, I might read it and think it's a novel 10 times better than either of those.
Well, I'm going to guess that I might get some convincingly Dickinsonian.
Dickensian.
I was going to say Dickensian. No, not Charles Dickens.
Okay.
Dickinson. I was saying Emily Dickinson.
Oh,
earlier.
Dickinson. Gotcha.
I'd say I'm sooner to get some convincingly Dickinsonian poetry than you are to get some convincing prose narrative.
I think you're on target there.
Yes.
I would imagine that we will see this develop over time in various fields, and the ones that will be conquered first will be the ones that require the least narration. The ones that will be conquered last will be really, really good poetry. Because obviously, one of the rules here is that the longer the form is, for a human anyway, the longer the form is, in general, the easier it is to write. Not that it's going to be easy to write a good one, but writing a good novel is easier than writing a good short story, because you have to make every word count. Writing a good short story is way easier than writing a really good poem, because you have even fewer words to work with.
Here's the thing, too, though. If we're considering creating stuff by generating rules in a dead author's voice, how much work they have available is going to be a big deal here.
Sure.
Somebody who's got, 70 novels that we can feed in to generate rules from is going to create a more robust AI voice than somebody who published one novel and that's it.
Sure. Yeah. That's very true. So, maybe we'll eventually get to a point where we have these computers just generating things in their own voices, in which case it'll all be zeros and ones, which will be a fascinating read. Binary, the novel. All right. So, no, this is a fun discussion. I am curious to hear what our listeners have to say about this. You should go to our website, fwthinking.com. That's where we have all the blog posts, podcasts, videos, articles, all relating to these topics are right there. Find the one for this podcast, the entry we have for the episode, and let us know what you think about the idea of computer-generated fiction. And tell us if you think that's ever going to be a reality, or what do you think the first computer-generated book will be about? Will it be The Mouse Who Loved Me? Maybe it's I Have No Mouse and I'm a Scream. Who knows? Apologies. All right, so let us know, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Are you looking to build this year? If so, there is no better time than right now to start planning and to get your spot on the construction schedule. If you need a garage, a stall barn, a storage for vehicles, RV, boat, collectibles, or even a shop for your farm, hobbies, or car restoration projects, visit MortonBuildings.com and start your construction process. With superior materials, craftsmanship, best-in-class warranty, Morton Buildings are made to last for generations. At Morton, the difference is in the details. From their cutting-edge innovations to their craftsmen in the field, they are dedicated to surpassing expectations. Their legacy of excellence spans more than 120 years, and Morton Buildings is 100% employee-owned with more than 250,000 satisfied customers. That means they're the industry leader you can trust. When you choose Morton, you'll experience quality at every step of the building process, starting before the walls even go up. Visit MortonBuildings.com to get started today.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from revisionist history. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.